Romans chapter 12. I'm going to make several references before I get there. So just be patient until we get there. Here's the gospel. Here's the problem. That since mankind has been recording its history, so long as we've been on the planet, there's been a problem, and it's this. We have this printed image on our hearts that tells us there is a creator. There is an ultimate source. Mankind has found hundreds of different words and names for him. In our Christian doctrine, we call him God, God the Father. And we've known since the dawn of human creation, human existence, that he's there. And we've also known we don't know how to knit with him. We don't know how to relate to him. We don't know how to reconcile to him. That's been the tension we've been dealing with since we started recording our history of existence. Because we recognize that we have a problem. We have an infection. We call it sin. And so we know there's this good and awesome and perfect God. And we know that we're somehow separated from him, and we've spent our entire existence in humanity trying to figure it out. And the good news of the gospel is that that creator, that God, that other, that divine figure knew that we were going to wrestle with that. And it's not a cruel joke on his part. He understood the design, and so he's provided a way, as he expressed himself in our world in the Son, his Son, Jesus Christ. He met us on our terms. He walked on our ground. He made himself tangible and approachable, conversational. And Jesus taught us that if you want to be reconciled to your Creator, I'm the way through which you do that. Faith in me and understanding of my teachings and following after what I'm about is going to get you to the reconciled place with God. That is the most profoundly positive message of hope that humanity is ever going to know. And every tension you observe in life, every wrong that you see out there, every brokenness that we know is existing out there, can somehow find its resolution in that message, the gospel of Jesus Christ, that you and I, and all our brokenness and all our inconsistencies and all our pain and all our suffering and all our tensions and all our anger can be reconciled to a perfect, loving God. At the core of every problem, every tension, the gospel is the answer. Now, that's not meant to be an oversimplification. I'm just saying we as the church bear the greatest message of hope that humanity is ever going to need. You don't seem to be all excited about that. But I'm telling you the reason we exist, the reason we gather together this morning, the reason we are doing life the way we do, the doctrines that we believe in as the Church of Jesus Christ, we carry the message of hope that all humanity needs. So why are Christians so angry? Why? You've been angry, I know you have been. You don't look angry right now, but I'm going to bet you have been at some point. At one point or another, maybe not this week, I'm just saying. I'm betting every single one of us at one point or another. And some of us, and maybe a lot of us in this room would say, no, I'm not angry, but I'm easily angered. The way I described it several weeks ago is sometimes it seems it's right there below the surface. Just peel back one layer, and there's the anger. And I was surprised how many of you came to me and said, oh, yeah, boy, you tell me when you're going to preach that because I don't want to be here. Because, yeah, I feel that, Pastor Steve, I know that. Why are Christians so easily angered if we possess the greatest hope, the greatest message that mankind is ever going to know? That's kind of been the point the last few weeks, is that we maybe peel back a layer and figure out why for some of us is it right there below the surface? Why are we angry more often than we want to be? Last week I started with giving us a few ideas about what causes our anger and why it's helpful for us to know that. We discovered a few weeks ago, first of all, anger is a process. It's a human, physical process that is absolutely appropriate for you to experience. Something triggers it. Something comes into your mind, and your mind, your brain, fires off something, and your body chemically responds, and certain endorphins and whatnot are released into your bloodstream, and it causes your heart to increase and your breathing to increase, and that whole experience is outside of your control because it's perfectly natural for that to happen. So everything between the stimulus, what caused the anger, and my response, it could be a matter of a second and a half. Everything in there is not in your control. But we are called to control. Now, what do I do with the fact that I'm now angry? We looked at the story of Cain and Abel. Cain was angry, killed his brother, and God comes to him, and surprisingly, doesn't start with an accusation. God starts with a question. What was God's question to Cain when he approached him? He said, Cain, what? Why are you so angry? What's the problem? How did you get here? How did you end up being so angry that you would do this? God starts a conversation. I think it cannot be understated that God was conversational and is conversational with us. How would the picture change if God was nothing but condemning? Shame on you. That was terrible. That was wrong. I don't want a faith like that. I don't want anything to do with that, right? But conversational God approaches and says, what's the problem? Can I talk with you? Will you talk with me? So it's not always wrong to be angry. Some of it is completely normal. There's justified anger. Next week, we're going to look at what we would call righteous anger, things that should get us angry. It's natural and it's not always wrong, but sometimes it is. Sometimes it is because, here, I'm going to give you a little clue. Maybe you've interacted with me enough to already know this. Please don't admit it too quickly that you already know this about me. But sometimes I'm selfish. Sometimes I'm a little bit self-absorbed. I don't mind saying that here. I feel pretty free to say it because you are too. In fact, what I need, just so that I don't feel too bad about myself, is I need you to say it with me. Say, sometimes I'm selfish. You didn't sound convinced. It sounded like you said it only because I told you to say it. Because human nature is about self-protection, self-defense, self-preservation. So I'm not quick to get up and admit that sometimes I'm selfish, and neither are you, but I think a lot of us know that's at the basis of some of it. Maybe it's at the basis for a lot of it. This anger that I've had, this tension that I seem to learn to live with, it's because sometimes I'm selfish. So I gave you a forewarning a couple weeks ago that as we look at some of the responses to anger, some of them are going to be costly. Some of them get in my face and say, are you serious? This is what I need to do? I already knew that's what I need to do. I just don't want to hear it. And I didn't want to have it that way. So we talked about some of the things that might cause us anger. And last week we classified some of it. For example, sometimes it's perceived injustice. I take a look around me and life doesn't seem fair, doesn't seem right, so it causes me frustration, it causes me anger. Some of it is actual injustice. It's not a matter of perception. It's not a matter of opinion. It is injustice and it's wrong. We see it sometimes, especially in the news, and we see things happen. We say, that's injustice. Sometimes I'm angry because my values have been attacked. The things that I find most valuable in my life, another person has opposed them or has attacked them. The example I gave you last week is, I value my family. I love my family. So you threaten my family, it's going to cause me to get angry very, very quickly, right? Sometimes my values are attacked. Sometimes anger is caused by ineffective communication. It just cannot seem to get this understanding. You're not listening, or I don't understand what you're saying. And it builds and it builds and it causes anger. I oversimplified some of the reasons that can cause us anger because it could be a lot more complicated than that. Sunday afternoon, when we went home last Sunday afternoon, I was reminded there's another cause for anger. It's called stupidity. Sometimes that causes anger. We were cleaning our oven, and I said, here, let me get the door off there for you, because it's much easier to clean when I get up. And so I don't know if you've noticed, but on your oven, when you close your oven door, it kind of snaps back into place, right? And that's because the hinges are spring-loaded. So when you pull the door down and you go to lift it off, don't put your hands anywhere near the hinges. They're going to snap back and cut your hands open. And as I'm rinsing my hands in the sink, I'm thinking, oh yeah, stupidity is another reason that causes anger. There's dozens of different reasons that might cause us anger, but I wanted to get us a sense of what some of them could be. Because when we understand what it is that's making you angry, you can help to determine an appropriate response. Rather than just, oh, here's this feeling again, I'm going to go storm off and do whatever. No, if I can figure out why I'm angry, I might figure out what the appropriate response is. And last week, I had you repeat this several times over, and then I realized I didn't do a really good job of explaining what I meant. But I said, one of the things we need to appreciate is that God's purposes are always, do you remember what the word was? Redemptive. God's purposes for the things that he allows into your life, some of them cause you anger, is because his purposes are always redemptive. And I was a little bit dense in the fact that I just assumed we all were using the word redemptive similarly. Here's what I meant by the fact that God's purposes are always redemptive. That what God intends for you, or you, or you, is each and every one of us as a person, is that as the gospel of Jesus Christ becomes increasingly realized in your life, you will experience and understand his blessing more and more and more. And it will be a renewal of your mind and a renewal of your heart and a renewal of your perspective on life. I will better appreciate and understand things now that I didn't a month ago or 6 months ago. That the revelation of his glory and his blessing in your life and in your sphere will become more and more evident to you. He is restoring all creation to the place where it started. And I'll tell you, I don't know exactly how the end is going to sort out, whether it's, you know, processed till eventually, or whether there's this, you know, the whole revelation thing, is some fascinating conversations that can happen there. God is going to bring all of creation back to its right place. And so the acceptance of the salvation of gospel of Jesus Christ is one thing. It happened in my life. I accepted the gospel. I'm saved. But now there's something called a sanctification through which he's constantly renewing me and constantly refreshing me. God's purposes for me are redemptive. And even though I find myself often going, God, I'm so sorry. I've dropped the ball on this again. I failed on this again. He's like, no, that's okay. Let's not leave you there. Let's rebuild you again. Let's rebuild you again, because God's purposes for you are always redemptive, pushing him towards his total renewal of all things, and that's you and I included. That's what he's about. That's his nature, is to renew and rebuild and forgive and restore. So I want you to keep in mind this idea that God's purposes are to constantly renew, constantly make you better, bring you to a better place. Gail Gustin approached me last week after the sermon, and she said, here's a little a wordplay that I've used that's really been helpful for me. She said, when I think of anger and what I can do about it, she said, I think of the word water. Go ahead and throw that up on screen. She said, here's the things that I understand about how to deal with anger. It's what I'm responsible. I'm responsible for my words, my actions, my thoughts, my emotions, and my responses. She says, outside of those things, I can't do much with anger. Sometimes I can't change the cause. I can't change the circumstances. I can't change the other person. But this is what I'm responsible for. Very helpful, right? You put in, anytime you put in a little poem or a little acronym somehow, that's helpful. But it's also very pressing for me to say to you this morning that when it comes to anger in your life, what to do with it, how to experience it, how to respond to it, that you are responsible for your words. You are responsible for your actions. You are responsible for your thoughts. We'll see that this morning in Scripture. You're responsible for your emotions. That can be a tricky one. I'm a more emotional person than the next. That can be, and you're responsible for your responses. So helpful, but somehow very challenging as well. Today I want to talk about some of our responses. Here's a critical question for us as we think of responding to perceived injustice. I'm going to pick up on the same causes that we talked about last week: perceived injustice, actual injustice, attacks on my values. How am I going to respond to perceived injustice? Go ahead to the next screen. Here's the thing. How do I know when I'm experiencing injustice if it's actual injustice, this is wrong, or if it's my opinion that it's wrong? And here's a good question I think we can ask ourselves. When we're facing something that's just not fair, here's the critical question. Is there any chance that this injustice could be understood differently by someone else? So I'm suffering this thing. It doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem fair. Here's a critical question. Go ahead, put it up on screen. Can the cause of this anger be interpreted differently by someone else? Or is it so blatantly obvious that all of us agree, yes, this is wrong for this reason? There's that great old adage, right? Never judge somebody till you walk a mile in their shoes. And do you know why that's a good adage to remember? It's because if you practice that, then when you finally judge somebody, you're a mile away and you've got their shoes. So it's much safer then to do it. Can this injustice against me, could it be perceived differently? Is it perhaps perceived differently by someone else? If the answer to that question is yes, then the injustice that I'm suffering is probably a perceived injustice. And I'm going to respond differently to perceived injustice than I am actual injustice. Perceived injustice, that is, it's unjust according to me, means I'm going to address my mind about it, not necessarily the issue itself. Psalm 73, we saw it last week. In the first half of the psalm, the psalmist is saying, God, I don't understand. There's other people who don't obey your word, who could care less about God's law and the way life is supposed to operate, and they seem to thrive. They seem to be doing fine. They're getting good things out of life. And so why would I concern myself with trying to obey your law when clearly you don't have to enjoy the best of life? That's a huge paraphrase, but that's basically the first half of Psalm 73. Psalm 73 is written by Asaph, who was the worship leader for all of Israel. He was the top of the priestly responsibility to lead Israel in worship. And here's Asaph saying, forget about leading other people in worship. I'm not even sure I agree with what's going on in the world. And so partway through the psalm, he says, you know, if I had really let myself linger in this, not only would it have caused damage to me, I would have led a whole bunch of people astray. But then, God, I entered your sanctuary. I entered your quiet space, and I reflected on what God is doing, and I realized that God's sense of justice is bigger than my own, and that my focus should be on worship of him, not on the things going on around me. So the entire psalm is this beautiful picture of this guy experiencing the tension that we all experience. Why do bad people still have good things happen to them? And then he realized, that's not where I got to let my mind stick. I got to focus on God and the bigger picture. And so he reorients himself. Psalm 26 and Psalm 139 are both these expressions that say, when I perceive injustice in the world, I don't think this is fair, it doesn't feel right. Psalm 26 and Psalm 139 say, God, search me. Look in my heart. And Psalm 139 specifically says, see if there's any oppressive way in me. See if there's something that's just not quite right. And if you find it, God, redirect me. Listen, if you're struggling with a sense of injustice in your world and you're not quite sure, is this just my attitude or is this actually legitimately wrong? You need to get familiar with Psalm 139. 139, those verses that says, search me and try me, and if there is something sideways in my heart, God, I'm going to allow you to reshape it. Powerful prayer, powerful scripture. Probably the one that we are more familiar with. You can go ahead to the next couple of points. Probably the one that we are more familiar with in the New Testament is when Jesus talks about, we got to be careful when we say to somebody, what is wrong with you with that speck of dust in your eye? Look at you walking around with that little speck of dust. You know how annoying it is to people? And then he says, except you've got a log in your own. He used this huge hyperbole, this extraction. Imagine how just ridiculous it would be if I'd had a piece of wood sticking out of my eye. And I came to you and said, Lisa, there's a speck in your eye. Crying out loud. Get rid of it. What is wrong with you? Meanwhile, right? We understand that sometimes this idea of perceived injustice, that we ought to be careful about saying to someone else, get it sorted when we've got this massive wound for ourselves. So how am I going to respond? How am I going to deal with anger that's caused by perceived injustice? It's called self-examination. I'm going to have to stop and say, okay, this has made me angry. I feel like I want to do this, but before I do this, let me just stop and see. God, search me and try me and either affirm for me, yes, this is wrong, or shape my heart differently. So I'm going to respond to perceived injustice in my anger by examining myself. Now, how am I going to respond to actual injustice? Now, we got to categorize this a little bit. Let's talk for a moment just about injustice that I observe as it's pressed on other people. I see someone else who is oppressed, someone else who is abused, someone else who is treated unjustly. How am I going to respond to that? Well, as a Christian, let me start by saying this. I hope it makes you angry. I hope it wakes you up enough to get out of your seat. I hope that as Christians, as followers after Christ, after a God who has redemptive purposes for all of creation, that when we see something that works against that, that we will actually stand up and do something about it. The problem is that sometimes I'm selfish. Say it again. Sometimes I'm selfish, so I don't respond to injustice, because I got enough going on in my own world, and I'm worried more about myself. But when we respond to actual injustice, first of all, we actually look to change the environment or change the culture. In Isaiah chapter 1, the people were trying to make their case that, God, we've come to you, and we worship you, and we bring you all the sacrifices. And God says, I couldn't care less about your sacrifices. The things that you're offering up to me in these burnt offerings are supposed to be sweet. It stinks. I want nothing to do with it. What I want for my people is to deal with injustice and take care of the oppressed, the orphans and the widows and the people that need help. Get off your butts and help them. That's the paraphrase of Isaiah 1. And don't come to me with all your expressions of worship until you've actually defended the poor and the needy. This is the heart of God, that his people would act justly. In Micah chapter 6, the same deal, talking about the people trying to find their way back to God through religious practices. And he says, it basically boils down to this: do justly. Take care of people who are being oppressed. Watch out for them. Act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Christians should, in our world, be the first line of defense for injustice. We ought not to be sitting back and waiting for our government to solve the problem. We ought not to be sitting back and waiting for NGOs and other charitable organizations to solve the problem. You and I, as people who are constantly being redeemed and renewed by God, ought to be responding to injustice in the world. One of the reasons that's at the base of why we're sending a team back to Magnetawan this year is because the injustice that has been dealt to our Indigenous peoples in Canada was in part at the hands of the church. And so we're just starting to learn how to eat that and recognize that we have a place as a church to respond to the sufferings of our Indigenous people in Canada. And so we're trying to find a right place in that, because the people of God should be responding to injustice that we see observed. We should respond. How do we respond to the anger that's caused by actual injustice? We get involved in justice. Social justice and doing what's right. All right, how am I going to respond to injustice that's propelled against me or attacks on my values? Well, in a practical sense, it may require that I need to establish some new boundaries. Someone has violated my principles, someone's purposed or practiced injustice against me. Maybe I need some new boundaries established in my life. I'm going to need to develop more self-control in my response so it doesn't just perpetuate the problem. Here's where it gets uncomfortable for us as followers after God. When we say, how do I respond to hardship and turmoil and injustice in my life? Scripture is filled with things like this. Go ahead, put this up on screen for us. 1 Peter and 1 Thessalonians, that says, when someone practices injustice against you, when they do something that's clearly wrong, don't repay them with equal wrong. Forgive them. Be gracious to them. Now, as you read through these words on the screen, is anybody here surprised at all that this is what the preacher preaches today? I'm not surprised by it. And I'll go a step further. I'm not satisfied with it sometimes either. I know it in principle, that when someone presses on me and does something to me that's wrong, I know that what I'm supposed to be is gracious and forgiving, but I sometimes feel like God's missing the opportunity to bring about justice. And if he was really a God of all justice, then he would punish this person for doing this to me. And maybe he wants me to be involved in that punishment. I wouldn't mind being involved in that punishment. I knew this was the answer. And so did you. You didn't need me to tell you that. I'm angry because injustice has been oppressed against me. Surprise, surprise, you're supposed to be gracious and forgiving about that. In Mark, in the Gospels, it's recorded that Jesus says, when you pray, make sure that you are forgiving to the people who've offended you if you want God to forgive you. Jesus ties this thing so tightly together that if you really want to understand the relationship that you have with God and the grace he's given you, then you need to be ready to extend that grace to others, or maybe you don't understand the relationship in the first place. Holy cow, are you kidding? Yeah, but. Some of the things that you've suffered unjustly in your life, you're absolutely right. You were wronged. That other person was wrong. It never should have happened. Not the point. God says, I'm not denying the fact that you've been treated unjustly. In Philippians chapter 2, Paul says it this way. In the church, in those who gather around the gospel of Jesus Christ, we're supposed to adopt the same attitude that he did. And that Jesus gave up everything fully in the right. No one was more right than Christ. And yet he chose to silence himself and set aside that and took a position of humility. And there's the pattern for us. So I see this and I say, how am I supposed to respond to actual injustice in my life? Wow, forgiveness and grace. And Romans chapter 12 says, do everything you can to promote peace in the world. Ephesians chapter 6 reminds us that we ought to be careful how we respond to those who oppose us, because our battle isn't with them. The battle that we're fighting and the tension that we're realizing is in the powers that are behind them, the divine powers of Satan, who's looking to undermine everything God is doing. Now, let me stop and just make a quick commentary on this idea of forgiveness and grace and suffering and justice. Because I don't feel that in my life, I'm talking to you personally about my story, my testimony, I don't think I have been the victim of just blatant suffering injustice, often, if at all, in my life. But some of you in this room probably have. There's probably more than one of us in this room who could say, no, I was abused. I was oppressed. I was hurt. There was other people that did things to me or brought pain into my life, and it was clearly wrong, it's clearly unjust. So I'm going to tread very carefully to say, hey, it's all grace, it's all forgiveness. Because here's what I've seen happen. And this is not, read a book about a story. This is people that I know, I've interacted with them, who've said, a spouse has been abused over and over and over again, and the defense has been, well, you're supposed to be forgiving. And I want to tell you this morning that that is a violation of the principles of the word of God's word for us. You cannot enact persecution and suffering into someone's life over and over and over again and then say, hey, you got to be forgiving. That's what a Christian's supposed to be. I think we're missing the points that God's purposes are always what? Redemptive. God's purposes for my wife are redemptive. He wants what's best for her. So there is no place in God's order for me to bring suffering on her over and over and over and just say, hey, you got to be forgiving. Because if I'm doing that, I'm working against the purposes that God has for her. You understand? Yes, I'm supposed to be forgiving. Yes, if you make a mistake, you speak pain into my life, I ought to be seeking ways to be gracious and be forgiving about that. But let's be careful we don't forget, God's purposes are always redemptive. So if someone is constantly bringing suffering into someone else's world that works against God's purposes, grace and forgiveness are measured together with truth and justice. And both are true. How do I respond to actual injustice that is suffered against me? I'm going to seek forgiveness and grace where I can, but I will not forget that God's purposes are redemptive. You look at the front of your bulletin, and I did this on purpose. Anybody be able to solve that math question? I actually don't think it's a real math question. I just grabbed an image off of Google. Three. Yes, you're right. It's three. I don't even know why I ask sometimes. Because this whole idea of resolving anger is not done in a 25-minute sermon. Oh, if he would only preach for 25 minutes, that'd be wonderful. 30, whatever, I'll keep it concise. We're not going to resolve it today, right? I hesitate to even start a sermon that says, here's some answers, here's some responses to anger. It's way more complicated than that. It's ridiculously complicated. I hope that you can take some principles from what we find in Scripture that will help you better deal with the anger in your world. But I don't think for one second I'm going to solve it all. But turn to Romans chapter 12. And here's a couple of quick principles that I'll finish up with that I think can be helpful to many of us. Paul isn't necessarily writing about, here's what a Christian should do when they are angry. James does that more directly in his letter than Paul does in this. But I want you to see something here I think is hugely helpful for us. Romans chapter 12 reads like this. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies, that is, your whole existence, everything about yourself, as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Verse 2, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. First point, how am I going to respond to anger in my way? How do I deal with anger? How do I rightly act out when I'm angry? Verse number 2 of Romans chapter 12. First of all, let's not conform to the patterns of this world. Let's not just default to the first thing that comes to mind. When suffering comes in this world, when one person enacts injustice against another, Curtis, tell me, what is the natural, normative, cultural, typical response to that? Flash it back. And that is normal. In fact, sadly enough, in our culture, it's pretty much acceptable that if I do something to you that's unjust, you have every right to flash back at me. And Paul says, hold on a sec. We live in this world, but let's not be part of it. Let's not conform to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. First thing that I'm going to do if I'm trying to develop better responses to anger is I'm going to reject the typical cultural normative patterns. Now, I started this morning by saying this. We have a problem because we were born into a nature. Thousands of years before you and I were here, there was this thing called human nature that said, eye for an eye, justice, get what's yours. And you were born into it and you're infected with it top to bottom. I understand that. Paul's talking about the transformation here. Do not be conformed to the way this world does things, demanding your rights. We have a propensity to self-preservation. But the first thing we're going to keep in mind as I try to develop a response to anger is I'm not going to be conformed to just what feels natural. Jump down to verse 14 of the same chapter. He says this, bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Paul is describing what it looks like when we don't do what's normal. It's not normal to do those type of things. Bless those who persecute you. He says that's the exact opposite of what your nature would tell you to do. How can I respond to anger and injustice? Maybe it's the exact opposite of what I think should be done. And the question is, oh, that's great. Go ahead and do that. How in the world do I do that? How do I just change my human behavior? And I don't want to be preached at. I don't want to come to the place and say, yeah, this is what you're doing, but this is what you should do. Now go on with you. Go and do that. Well, Paul must have preempted the question because he talks about renewal further on here. Look at verse 3. If the question is, how do I change my behaviors? For by grace given to me, he says, every one of you, do not think of yourselves more highly than you ought to. So before I respond, before I'm just, my behaviors are going to change, the first thing is, maybe I ought to think differently about myself. Sober judgment. Before I react to this thing, let's just stop and think, okay, is my attitude right about this? He says, be careful not to think too highly of yourselves in this, in accordance with others, and keep them in mind as well. Philippians talked about the same thing. Consider others more highly than yourself. In Philippians chapter 4, as a support to this, Paul goes on and he says, listen, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is praiseworthy, the good, the essential, let your mind dwell on those things. Think about those things. Let me ask you this. When you're faced with something that's frustrating you or angering you or an injustice that's been acted against you, something that's not right, something that's hurtful, something that's disappointing, whatever, what do we tend to dwell on? Where does our mind usually hang? On that thing. I think about it again, and I'll find ways to describe how wrong that is. And I'll think about it again so I can rephrase it so when someone actually asks me about that, I can articulate it so beautifully, you will get angry with me. And we dwell on those things. I can't believe that person did that and they said that. And we go over it. Oh, yeah, I see you. I see the little smiles. You're careful not to indicate too much. Tells me you do it too. We dwell on the thing that's been done. We dwell on the thing that I'm not happy with. How could they have done that? That's where our mind lingers, right? When things don't go well and when I'm angry. And Paul says in Philippians 4, wait a minute, put your mind on the things that are true and just, and he uses the word lovely and praiseworthy. How much of our tension, how much of our anger do you think would be resolved if we said, when I'm angry and when something unjust has been done towards me, I'm going to intentionally tell myself to dwell on solution rather than problem. I'm going to fix my mind on the things that are actually helpful. I'm going to teach myself how to respond to this person in a way that's careful, choosing the right words. I mean, if I force myself, if I discipline myself to set my mind on that which is honorable and good and right and just, I would not be as angry. But instead, the human nature is dwell on the problem, dwell on the issue, identify why they're wrong. Paul says, put your mind on other things, and the result will be that we will find ways to deal with anger. You got to decide for yourself where you're going to let your mind dwell. Pastor Steve, how does a Christian respond to anger? This is clearly in your court. This isn't for someone else to do. This is on your shoulders, and it's this. You got to decide where you're going to let your mind dwell. Because if you are determined to think on the issue, think on the problem, identify the wrongness of it, there is nothing else that can be done that's going to get you out of that angry pocket. You got to determine where you're going to let your mind linger. And if we're willing to let our mind linger on that which is true and that which is honorable and right and good, we will find a way out of that place. Romans chapter 12, reject that which is a normal response and let your mind be renewed. Well, let me finish with two very quick comments. How do I renew my mind? First of all, you're going to renew it in prayer. Get familiar with Psalm 139. Get familiar with Psalm 73. Get familiar with Psalm 26. I'm tense, I'm angry, I'm frustrated, life isn't working out. Get to know those prayers that basically say, where did you go, God? Life is not being fair to me. This is what I'm suffering. It doesn't seem right. And listen to the voice of the psalmist as they sift that through. You don't just read words on the page. You see a process. Get familiar with that through prayer. How do I renew my mind? I renew my mind through the words of prayer. And the psalms help me do that. And second one is this. You are not going to likely do it alone. How do I deal with anger? How do I learn better responses to anger? How do I sift some of it? You are very likely not going to do it by yourself. Solitude is a great discipline. If you want to get someplace and quieten yourself away from the busyness and sift through a self-examination. Self-examination is probably better done in solitude. Sorting through your problems is very likely not. Because, as I started this morning, we have a problem. We have a sin nature that is born out of selfishness and pride. And the likelihood of me undoing that by myself is almost zero. But doing it amongst other people and other believers, to be able to sit with somebody and say, I've been suffering this, I'm struggling with this. Have you ever struggled with that? Because more than likely the answer is what? Yes, I understand that struggle. I understand that struggle. You see a couple posters in the building for our small group ministry that we're looking to get some really energy in behind. And I want you to know that the small group ministry that we're propelling at this church is not because in 2018 churches should have small groups. I could care less what the politically correct idea of, you know, churches should this or churches should that. We believe very much so that your faith and my faith, our faith as individuals, is best grown in community with other people, where I can sit in a safe environment and say, you know, I've never really understood this scripture. Have you ever sort of, or I had this problem, I have this struggle, or Pastor Steve's sermon made me so angry. Did it make you angry too? Yeah, let's get rid of that guy. Like, don't have those conversations. But we are better served when we do it in community with one another. So for many of us, we'd say, I don't know, small groups is not my thing. You do me a favor. Next week, next Sunday, the 24th, take a few minutes after the service, go to the library, and ask a couple questions about it. Just find out what's the point, what are we trying to do, what are the opportunities? Because for you and I to understand and get a handle on our anger, we'll very likely have a much greater success if we're doing that alongside other people. We are not alone in this. Next week, we're going to take a look at James chapter 1. As he talks about anger, he says in the reading we saw this morning, everybody should be slow to anger. Well, I should be, but I'm not, so what am I going to do with that? And I'm going to take a look at the picture of Jesus clearing the temple. What an odd thing that our God, redemptive in his nature and loving in his purposes, is seen at one time making a whip and driving people out of a space. And if you think for one second he wasn't angry in that moment, you've misunderstood the passage. He was angry in that moment. So if you want to come to church next week, if you want to come to church and feel free to get angry, make sure you're here next week. Because there is such a thing as righteous anger. We just got to learn how to discern the two between it. I'm going to ask our worship team to come on up here and get ready to help us with a song this morning. If I'm not mistaken, it's Lord, I Need You. Lord, I need you to sift my heart and my mind. This is the words, this is the expression of Psalm 139. I'm not exactly sure how to respond to this anger because I don't know if it's real injustice. I don't know if it's just the way I'm seeing it. God, I need you to change me. I want to renew my heart and my mind, and I can't do that by myself. I can't do it just because I want to. I need God to interject himself into my heart and my mind and do that. So let's, in response to this idea of dealing with anger, and I know I have to be renewed, and I'm not sure how to be, let's stand together and just say this. God, I need you. I need you to help me with this. Go stand with us, please, as we respond in song.